A bestia. נו.
אנחנו קוראים מתוך הספר הבחירה היהודית איחוד או אנטישמיות את הפרק
השני. We are reading from the book The Jewish Choice, Unity or Antisemitism, chapter 2. Title
חורבן בית המקדש הראשון והגלות שנגרמה כתוצאה מכך היו פרק עצוב בתולדותינו. אחד מתוך רבים שעוד יבואו. מבין 12 השבטים,
the 12 tribes that were consist the people of Israel, only the tribes of Judah, Levite, and part of Benjamin returned after the exile. However, the strength of the Jewish people was never measured in the number of its members, but to the extent it was united. Exile in Babylon continued as long as the Babylonians remained separate. Sorry, as long as the Jews remained separate from one another. In Megillat Esther, the Jews were able to save themselves, but Haman, the anti-Semite, told the king Ahasuerus that the Jews are separated, that there is a people that is separated among all the nations in all of your countries. The Kli Yakar, the interpretation of the Torah from the 17th century, writes that this single nation which is separated means that they were scattered and dispersed from one another. Likewise, the prominent interpretation of Jewish law, Yalkut Yosef, takes separated to mean that there was separation of hearts among them. Adding that the Jews do not observe the king's laws, it was a no-brainer for Haman to sway King Ahasuerus to give them permission to exterminate them. Yet each year on Purim, we celebrate the miracle of our survival because in the very last minute, Mordechai, the Jew, united all the Jews. Go gather all the Jews, meaning tell them words of blandishment, so they will be in one unity. Go gather as one the hearts of all the Jews. This telling 18th century description by Chaim Yosef David Azulay, the Chida, demonstrates the description of Esther and Mordechai at the prospect of seeing their entire fold obliterated. Their last resort was unity. When they united, they saved themselves, their people, and facilitated the beginning of the return from Babylon. The book Torat Emet explicitly warns that when all of Israel are in complete unity, no harm will come upon them. Indeed, wicked Haman complained about Israel that they are a scattered and separated people, that there is separation of hearts among them. Therefore, Esther suggested that they would all gather into one place and become one bundle, and their salvation would quickly come. And as was said in previously mentioned Midrash Tanchuma, if a person takes a bundle of reeds, he will certainly not be able to break them all at once. But taken one by one, even a small child can break them. So is the power of Israel. When they are all one bundle, when they are united together, they are rewarded and delivered. So the Jews were saved by uniting, just as they were delivered from Egypt when they united under Moses' leadership. When they came out of Egypt, they were given sovereignty in the land of Israel, though after a long and arduous journey. Now too, once they united under Mordechai's leadership, they regained their sovereignty and rebuilt the temple, though again After hardships and conflicts, they had to overcome.
But
unlike Egypt, this time they did not have to flee. Instead, they left Babylon not only with the king's blessing, but with his full moral, financial, and spiritual support. As soon as Cyrus came to power, he felt that God had ordered him to send the Jews back to their land and rebuild the temple. He sensed he had been commanded to help them in their task. He gave the famous Cyrus Declaration, which stated, "Every Jewish survivor, at whatever place he may live, let the men of that place support him with silver and gold, with goods and cattle, together with a freewill offering for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem." After his order was carried out, King Cyrus brought out the utensils of the house of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and put in the house of his gods. The Cyrus Declaration marked the official end of the exile in Babylon and the beginning of the era of the Second Temple, though the temple itself had not yet been built. During that period, the Jews achieved great heights, but subsequently declined to two civil wars, the last of which was so bloody and brutal that it left the Romans aghast at the brutality of the Jews towards their brethren. As we will see later in this book, by the time the Romans entered the city and the temple, there was very little left to ruin. The Romans merely completed the dispersion of an already disintegrated nation and sent the people of Israel to an exile that has not ended since, despite the re-establishment of the State of Israel.
Questions? If there are any questions, please. I was just told, or not, I actually read somewhere that Cyrus was the son of King Queen Esther. So, blood-wise, he was a Jew. So, the son of Esther and Ahasuerus. Yeah, who's there?
It seems that in this dynamics of connection is good, separation is bad, upon which this book is based on, that axis, the connection is always momentarily. There's connection, then immediately Israel goes back to separation.
Of course. The moment they completed the first temple, immediately there were wars. There were also wars before, here and there, but at the moment it was completed, that's it.
So what kind of solution are we offering?
The solution really will be the final solution, which is the final correction. Before that, nothing stops.
If we come with that message, say, to the people of Israel, they'll say, fine, we'll connect, and then immediately separation will be revealed. So,
of course, separation will appear, and then you'll connect more, further and further, again and again, until you reach the final correction, until all vessels will be connected. What else did you think? I don't understand. How did you think about the process?
I understand this well. I'm talking in terms of the message.
Explain to them, yeah, sure.
In terms of this message, separation also isn't bad. The separation leads to the next connection and so on.
That's in terms of the process, not the goal. We must always yearn for connection, and if on the way there are crises or corrupted vessels that arise, then we have to explain that it's correct that they appear that way.
Continuing that question, this week I heard the writer's meeting and he said that we're not discovering chassadim in the world, and that's why the world is going towards...
Sure, what else the world is missing?
Right, what's Lear saying? Okay, the evil is revealed, we'll connect and then evil will be revealed again. What we might be lacking to understand is that we're lacking connection, not for the evil to be revealed again, but otherwise, the end of the world, it seems. That's what it feels like.
If you uncover chassadim, then nothing bad appears, because the whole upper light that appears without chassadim, that's really bad. That's a knife, that's fire. It's the fire of hell, the upper light, if it appears without the garment of chassadim. However, if you first bring the garment of chassadim, it appears as great abundance.
Is there a different form to say it? It's clear, but can we say it in terms of connection?
By the connection, you awaken chassadim in the world. And then all the light that comes to advance the people of Israel and the whole of humanity to correction goes into the chassadim that you've already prepared from below. Chassadim come from below, from above comes light of chokhmah.
And that depends only on us, this chassadim?
Of course, who else it depends on? Only the connection between us. Is that clear, guys? This is understood, yeah? What?
Again, how do we increase the chassadim?
Oh boy. Through connection between us, we draw the light that reforms called chassadim. These chassadim spread between us. We as if are filled with a cloud of chassadim, and then the upper light that comes to us in order to promote us is called light of chokhmah. So it doesn't stab us like a knife. It rather is clothed with chassadim, and accordingly we attain the Creator. According to our equivalence of form with our light of chassadim, which is bestowal, and the light of chokhmah coming from his part.
This expansion of chassadim to the world after we do the work between us, the work of connection. Should there be such an action that we do physically, let's say dissemination, or is it enough that we connect between us?
Theoretically, it is sufficient for us to connect, but where will you bring proof that you actually have chassadim? What are you doing in practice? The Creator wants to appear in the beings in the world clearly. Okay? You want to ask something? No? Yeah, okay, Chaim there, poor guy.
Just to continue that, Rav, let's say the message goes through in Israel, at least in Israel. And people accept it. What actions or what things do they need to do? Because once I remember that you said they'll just do a tiny action towards connection. What's that tiny action towards connection?
That is what you need to put together. Circles of people, lists, build a list of the supporters of that process of uniting the people. Do something so a person will have something to do. I subscribed to the process of the unity of the people. And let's say I even registered for it, and it cost me 20 shekels. It's an action. It's worthwhile to do.
There are... Could it be that we start organizing some way like tens around Israel?
It's not tens, I don't know. It's the place called Unity of the People or something of the sort. And there you keep advertising different things, discussing it. Perhaps they'll start conversing between themselves, but something. Start organizing it. Otherwise, no one sees what we're doing. We're just talking between ourselves, staying in these four walls. talking about the unity of the people. Well, what kind of thing is that?
In most cases, when we go out and talk about unity, everyone goes, yes, yes, right, right, of course. What's next? Unity, unity, and what's next? What you said is what's next?
At least that. And then we have to think about how to get organized in a way that if it's important and we have to be organized, all people of Israel, this way, then how do we do it? Through the most acceptable way, which is a political party. Through formal channels of influence and ideological and so on for uniting the people. Okay. Let's continue.
Title, 70 Translators Who Almost Saved the World. Whenever we Jews are given freedom, division and strife surge among us. It is our nature to be an obstinate and stiff-necked nation. My teacher's father, Rav Yehuda Ashlag, known as Baal HaSulam, after his Sulam letter commentary on the Zohar, poignantly described what happens when Jews debate, which what the Talmud calls stabbing each other with the swords in their tongues. Ashlag stated that when Jews argue, they believe that in the end, the other side will understand the peril of his own view and will bow his head and accept their others, the other one's view. But I know that even if we bind them up together, one will not yield to the other even a bit. And no danger will interrupt anyone from carrying out his ambition. In accord with our nature, as soon as Cyrus sent us to Israel as a free people, we began to argue over the building of the temple and the nature of our restored sovereignty. But one way or the other, the temple was eventually built. But more importantly, for a brief period of time, unity was restored, and that period was a beautiful one in the pain-stricken history of our people. By the 3rd century BCE, relative calm prevailed in the nation as the people united around the temple in Jerusalem. 3 times a year, they would march up to Jerusalem to celebrate the festival of pilgrimage, Sukkot, Hanukkah, and Passover. During the pilgrimage, each of which lasted at least a week, the sight was spectacular. The pilgrimages were intended primarily for gathering and uniting the hearts of the members of the nation. In his book, The Antiquities of the Jews, Flavius Josephus writes that the pilgrim would make acquaintance maintained by conversing together and by seeing and talking with one another, and so renewing the recollection of this union. Once they entered Jerusalem, the pilgrims were greeted with open arms. The townsfolk let them into their homes and treated them as family, and there was always room for everyone. The Mishnah relishes this rare camaraderie. All the craftsmen in Jerusalem would stand before them and ask about their well-being. Our brothers, men of so-and-so place, have you come in peace? And the flute would play before them until they arrived at Temple Mount. Additionally, all the material needs of every person who came to Jerusalem were met in full. One did not say to one's friend, I could not find an oven on which to roast offerings in Jerusalem, or I could not find a bed to sleep in Jerusalem. Even better, the unity and warmth among the Hebrews projected outward and became a role model for the neighboring nations. the philosopher Philo of Alexandria portrayed the pilgrimage as a festival. Thousands of people from thousands of cities, some by land and some by sea, from the east and from the west, from the north and from the south, would come each festival to the temple as if to a common shelter, a safe haven protected from the storms of life. With hearts filled with good hopes, they would take this vital vacation with sanctity and with glory to God. Also, they make friendships with people they had not met before. And in the merging of the hearts, they would find the ultimate proof of unity. Philo was not the only one who admired what he saw. Those festivals of bonding served as a way for Israel to be, for the first time since they were given that vocation, a light onto nations. The book Sifrei Dvarim details how Gentiles would go up to Jerusalem and see Israel and say, it is becoming to cling only to this nation. This era in the history of our nation is probably the only time where we could see a living proof that the antidote to Jew hatred was not assimilation, but rather internal union. Historian Paul Johnson, whom we mentioned earlier, writes about that relatively peaceful time in our history. The years 400 to 200 BC are the lost centuries of Jewish history. There were no great events or calamities they chose to record. Perhaps they were happy, he concludes. Some three centuries later, the book of Zohar described succinctly and clearly the process that Israel went through. Behold, and how good and how pleasant it is for brothers also sit together. These are the friends, as they sit together, and are not separated from each other. At first they seem like people at war, wishing to kill one another. Then they return to being in brotherly love. And you, the friends who are here, as you were in fondness and love before, henceforth you will also not part from one another, and by your merit there will be peace in the world. Indeed, being a light unto nations could not have been more evident than at that time.
So we see here that the book is written for common people, for ordinary people, without some spiritual elevation. Rather, you want peace, well-being, no wars, no troubles, no eco-climate disasters, etc. Just unite, come and connect, and things will be good. That's all.
What was at that time that it held?
Relative unity among the people. Relative, but still unity. You see how there was a pilgrimage in Jerusalem, there were times of connection, place for connection. That's how it was.
Like Lear said, it was always very short periods of time. Here it was longer.
I don't know, I don't make these calculations. It's your speculations. That's what it writes, and I'm seeing the result. You're saying, no, it was only 300 years, it was only three times a year, and therefore, I don't go there. Why are you so smart? You have to immediately just study the principle. What do I care right now? The principle is simple. Connection is for the better.
There's also the matter of us being in the bottom-up process, and everything before was top-down, from in terms of development of humanity and also towards correction. Now, connection and unity of ours, will that take a different form of the way it was before?
I don't know how you're looking at history. When did it start from bottom up? From what year?
I don't know, maybe from the time Baal Sulam started now, or the Ari actually, that it starts from bottom up. I'm talking now about the future forms towards unity. Here there was a form of how they went to the temple, etc. These forms of unity will be different. Will they be any different from like this festival?
This I don't know. I don't want to also want to know. I know what I have to do. You have such a broad mind that you're already changing things from top down and bottom up. I'm not relying on what seems to me this or that way. Just get the approach. I don't imagine to myself that from Baal Sulam or from our time, we are in the last generation and it's only from bottom up, and before that everything was top down. I'm not saying you're not right somewhat. To some extent you are, but I don't want to speak this way to people. No, I want to see what is ahead of us right now. If we make one, two, three, a few steps forward, we'll know a bit better, and then maybe we can understand these things. In the meantime, you're extracting everything from your mind, and your mind today is not your mind tomorrow, I hope. So, wait. That'll be better. Starting to make these connections now and these assumptions, I don't respect that.
I'm also asking, it just came up now, like this form of festival, maybe it doesn't sound too, you know, attractive to people. They're not really attracted. It doesn't sound like such a something that's much better than their life they're living now.
I agree with you, except that the life will be much worse, and then it will be heard. What can I do? This just shows us how much we have to discuss this more and more and convince ourselves before we even make a step outwards. Go ahead.
Title, Talking Politics. By the mid-2040s BC, at the height of that peaceful era in our history, the rumor of Israel's wisdom had reached far and wide. Ptolemy II, king of Egypt, also known as Ptolemy Philadelphus, had two passions in life, women and books. Lewdness aside, Ptolemy's passion for books led him to aspire to possess all the books in the world, especially those containing wisdom. Demetrius Palearius, Ptolemy's librarian, was zealously subservient to his king's passion, wrote Josephus. When Ptolemy asked how many books he had already possessed in his library, the enthusiastic servant announced festively that he had already assembled 200,000 books, and that soon he would have 500,000 in his bigger-than-anybody's library. Yet this did not satisfy the king of Egypt. He told Demetrius that he had been informed that there were many books of laws among the Jews worthy of inquiring and worthy of the king's library. Not only did Ptolemy not have these books, but even if he did, he would not be able to read them, since they were written in characters and in a dialect of their own Hebrew, which will cause no small pains to get them translated into the Greek tongue. To achieve this feat, Demetrius wrote to none other than the high priest in Judah, asking his assistance in the matter. Ptolemy II, Philadelphus, inherited 120,000 Jewish slaves from his father, Ptolemy I, Soter, who himself received them from his patron, Alexander the Great, who had made him ruler of Egypt. Ptolemy I was not only Alexander's companion, but also a historian, and his son, Ptolemy II, had inherited his father's fervor for knowledge and was willing to go a long way to get it. When Ptolemy II, Philadelphus, ordered Demetrius to write to the high priest in Jerusalem, one of the king's closest friends, Aristarchus, reminded him that he had those 120,000 Jewish slaves under his yoke, and that perhaps, as a trust-building gesture, he should set them free. In fact, Aristarchus did more than that. He told the king that that God who supports your kingdom was the author of their laws, as I have learned by particular inquiry. And we also worship the same God, the framer of all things. The conclusion of Aristeus' campaign was that Philadelphus ordered every single Jewish slave freed, whether they were brought to Egypt by Alexander the Great or at any other time, and that the king's treasury would recompense every slave owner by the substantial amount of 120 drachmas. Within a week, every Jew in Egypt was a free person. Subsequently, feeling he had paid his dues to God, Philadelphus summarily turned his attention to getting the Jewish sacred books translated. He could not wait to wrap his mind around the wisdom of the Jews and the laws of Moses. First, he wrote to Eleazar, the high priest, telling him of the release of the Jews and of his intention to translate the Hebrew scriptures. To show his admiration for the Jews, he showered Eleazar with gold and luxurious artifacts. The high priest replied very warmly and naturally accepted his request to send translators. 70 men were sent down to Egypt following Ptolemy's request. But the king did not send them off to work right away. First, he wanted to learn their wisdom and absorb whatever knowledge he could from them. Therefore, he asked every one of them from a philosophical question, which were rather political questions and answers tending to the good government of mankind. For 12 straight days, the Hebrew sages sat before the king of Egypt and taught him governance according to their laws. Along with Ptolemy sat his philosopher, Mandamus, who was in awe at how such a force of beauty was discovered in these men's words, Finally, when they had explained all the problems that had been proposed by the king about every point, he was well pleased with their answers. He said that he had gained very great advantages by their coming, for that he had received this profit from them, that he had learned how he ought to rule his subjects. Philo, the Jewish Hellenized philosopher, wrote about that session that the answers of the wise men were a feast of words full of wit and weight. Once Ptolemy was satisfied with the answers they had given him, he sent them off to an isolated location where they had peace and quiet and could focus on the translation. According to Josephus, they made an accurate interpretation with great zeal and great pains, while the food was provided for them in great plenty. Besides, Dorotheus, at the king's command, brought them a great deal of what was provided for the king himself. When they completed their task, they handed over the king the complete translation of the Pentateuch. Ptolemy was delighted with hearing the laws read to him and was astonished at the deep meaning and wisdom of the legislator. The Talmud relates to the feat of the translation as a miracle. King Ptolemy, king of Egypt, writes the Talmud, assembled 22 elders from the sages of... assembled 72 elders from the sages of Israel and placed them in 72 separate houses. At first, he did not disclose to them why he had gathered them, so they would not consult with one another in advance. Then he went to each and every one of them separately and told them, "Write for me," meaning translate for me the law of your great sages Moses. Then God placed in their heart for each of them counsel and understanding, and they all agreed to one view. Then, not only did they translate properly, but where they changed, they made the same changes. Miracle or not, at long last, some 12 centuries after being tasked with serving as a light unto nations, it seemed like the Jews were finally on track to being so. Now that the translation was done, King Ptolemy sent the sages back to Jerusalem with a letter to Eleazar the high priest requesting that he would give these interpreters leave if any of them were desirous of coming to him, because he highly valued a conversation with men of such learning. This perhaps is what Paul Johnson meant when he wrote about the society of the Jews being made as a pilot for humanity to emulate.
We don't have more translation for now, yeah? Dudi?
No, tomorrow we'll have chapter 3.
Alright, so we read 2 chapters out of how many?
Out of 9.
Okay. What's the impressions? There's no other choice. We're going to have to go into a little bit of history, a little bit of geography, and all those things in order to show that the cases are that if we unite, we always gain. All right. So we have about an hour left. Okay. What are we doing? Ah, we have the discussion, right? Where? Yes, please.